Welcome everyone to Shuli's new series. Stones and Story is a journey through biblical architecture. So I feel like Shuli hardly needs an introduction at this point. She has a graduate degree in Jewish history from Columbia. She has been giving professional tours around Israel, giving text and tour courses at Pardes and Matan. And yeah, for the next 10 weeks, we'll be looking at the texts of Nach and their context in the various archaeological sites in Israel. It's too bad we couldn't be at joining you there in
It's
person,
true.
truly, but
It's 99.2.
sure we're all grateful for the chance to join you here.
Okay, thank you, Maxine. Wow, a lot of numbers. I don't know if that's because everybody is interested in this topic or because you're all stuck at home because everybody knows someone who's tested positive. Whatever reason it is, we're happy to have you. Okay, so let's get started. Maxine just put the sources in the chat. There aren't so many sources, but timeline, a few interesting things that are important. So the idea behind this course is we are going to go back to basics, back to Tanakh, to biblical history. And over the course of 10 weeks, what we're going to do is we're going to do more or less two classes per book, right? Nevi'im Rishonim, from Joshua through the book of Kings, with a little bit of a taste at the end of the time of Yirmiyahu, of Jeremiah, and then of Shivat Zion, of the return to Zion. So that's our goal, to get a little bit of the sense of the connection between the land and the text. And obviously this is the tip of the iceberg. There's so much to talk about here. And of course we want this to be a real trip one day and you'll go and see, but this is good preparation. Okay. So today we are going to start with the first of two about the book of Joshua, Sefer Yehoshua. The way I divided it up was that this week we're going to do kind of an overview and focus on entering the land, Knisa la'aretz, as well as the conquest. Next week, we're going to talk about the blessings and the curses and use that as a great jumping off point to talk about Mount Gerizim, Mount Ebal, Shechem, the Shomronim, that whole area. Okay, so that's the basic division. Before we get started in understanding the book of Joshua, I just want you to take a look at this slide because I love it. This is from a medieval manuscript, an illustration of the book of Joshua. And you can see what is it, right? The key is the pasuk, is the verse that's written above. It is closed and enclosed, right? This is the pasuk that it says about Yericho when Bnei Israel come and start to conquer it. It is sogeret umisugeret. And what the illustrator decided to do here, and this is based on a midrashic text, is to give Yericho not one wall, but seven walls, right? So it's just a great, great picture, not in any way based on archaeology, as we're going to see. But it is fun to look at. So we're gonna, like I said, take a look at entering the land, the moral side of it, the religious side of it. We're also gonna try to understand a little bit, and again, this is a very tricky subject, and we're gonna be coming across it all the time when we talk about Tanakh, which is how much of Tanakh are we taking at face value? How much do we say is contradicted by archaeology? How much does it, you know, does archaeology back things up? We're going to see that in some places the stories are very clearly confirmed by archaeology. Hazor in Yericho, Hazor in the book of Joshua is a great example. Other stories, the archaeology seems to contradict, seems to be very problematic, and that's Yericho, right? So we have different issues that we're going to talk about. We also have the very interesting kind of internal Tanakh debate. It's not necessarily presented as a debate in Tanakh, but you learn the book of Joshua, and then you learn the book of Judges, right? Yoshua and Shoftim, and they're clearly presenting two very different pictures, right? The book of Joshua, we come in and we conquer, and everything falls one domino after another, and by chapter 12, that's it. The whole country has been conquered, everybody has been subjugated, and Bnei Israel are triumphant. We open up the book of Judges, as we're going to do in a couple of weeks, and we'll see that, wait a second, we have challenges from the Canaanim, and we have challenges from the Midianim, and we have challenges from the Plishtim, and what's going on, right? What happened to that nice, neat conquest that we had before? So there are definitely conflicts. The question is, does it all happen at once, like it says in Sefer Yoshua, or is it something that perhaps is more gradual over time, right? It's not at all clear, but I think one of the ways that might be instructive to look at it, you can think about it as you will, I try not to bring in politics too much, but I think it's an interesting contrast, is modern Israel, right? Six-Day War and the aftermath of the Six-Day War. Six-Day War is this lightning conquest, right? We conquer all these places, Yehudah and Shomron and the Golan and the Sinai, right? We have all these places. But for the ensuing 50-plus years, we are struggling with the populations of these places. So it might have been a lightning conquest, but it doesn't mean that everything fell into our laps. So we're going to be looking at that as well. One other thing that's important to have as kind of a background is the decline of Egyptian power. Okay, what we're going to see in Sefer Yoshua in the second part of this class today is the falling one after the other of all of these various cities, starting with Jericho and then the Givonim and the northern cities, right? The Ai. And each one seems to have a melech, right? Each one seems to have its own king. Clearly, there's no king of the Givonim. It's not that big a place. But what you have is you have a lot of local monarchies, right? Local leadership that do not somehow seem to think that it's a good idea to combine with each other. So, right, the northern kings do work together and the Givonim, the four cities do work together. Why don't the Givonim or the people of Jericho join with the northern cities? Why don't they all make a coalition together? That's an interesting question. And part of it is because up until very soon before Bnei Israel entered the land, the Egyptians are in power in the land of Canaan, right? They are the rulers and it's behooves them, it suits them to have very decentralized power, that each town is dependent. I guess you could say centralized might be a better way to say it. Each town is completely dependent on Egypt and none of them connect with each other. And this way, Egypt is the ruler and there's no rebellion. But once Egypt leaves and there's a vacuum of power, these guys don't really know how to work together, mm-hmm. right? And that's a fascinating thing that we're going to see as we go along. Okay, so let's move on from here and get into more of a question of where and when and what. Okay, so where is our story mostly taking place? So here we have this kind of a pariv little map here. Let's draw on it, right? Bnei Israel, after wandering around the desert for a very, very, very long time, right, finally enter the land. Where do they enter the land? Over here. Right, Neged Jericho, opposite Jericho. We're going to see they cross the Jordan. We're going to get to that story more in more detail. By the way, this is not important to us now, but it will be important to us in a few weeks. At the very same time that Bnei Israel are making their entrance from the eastern side, you have another peoples that are making their entrance from the western side, and that, of course, are the Plishtim. Okay, so those are going to be important for us later, but less important for us now. Okay, Bnei Israel enter the land, crossing over near Jericho. First, they conquer Jericho. Then they conquer the Ai, right? Then they have the whole area of the Givonim. We eventually get up to the north and the area of Hatzor, and they conquer up there. In between, we are also going to have the story of the blessings and the curses, like I said, what we're going to do tomorrow, and that's in the area near Shechem. Plus, we also have giving out the land after the conquest is over, and that's in Shiloh. Okay, so if that hasn't confused you enough with all these nice little marks, okay, one more thing I want to notice in the progression of the conquests, and this happens very nicely. There are a few things that happen in the progression. First of all, Bnei Israel are moving from east to west, right? They're starting in Jericho, then they're taking the area of the Givonim, and once they have a effectively cut the country in half, right, by taking this middle area. Only then did they move up and take the area of the north. So that's important. What's also interesting is that in archaeological surveys that have been done in the last 40, 50 years, we see that the settlement pattern, right, the new settlement pattern of the Israelites, because they make different kinds of settlements than the Canaanites, they also move from east to west, right? They start out in the Jordan Valley, and then they move towards Samaria, towards Judah. So there is a progression like that as well. So that's also interesting to keep in mind. A different progression, not a geographical progression, but important as well, and this is pointed out by David Nativ, Yeshivat Har Etzion, is that the battles, if you think about it, right, think about Yericho and the Ai and the Givonim and the northern communities, the battles go from more miraculous with a lot of divine intervention, think Yericho, walls falling down when the shofars blow, to less and less miraculous, right? The Ai, God helps them. The Givonim, God sends down, you know, stops the sun. But still, Yoshua is the one who has to figure out the military strategy. And by the time they get up to the north, basically, it's just the army that's working, right? So you go from much more miraculous to a much more natural way of being. And that fits beautifully with one of the themes of Sefer Yoshua, which is that we have to go from our completely miraculous life in the desert, right, where we're dependent on God for food, for water, for everything, to living a normal life in the land, right? So that's just a nice thing to keep in mind as we go through all these various battles and the trajectory of the story here. Just to give us a bit of an overview, always helpful, right? An outline of the book in case you haven't learned it since you were in like fourth grade. Hopefully you have. Okay, or this will give you an impetus to go and learn it. The first five chapters are essentially about entering the land, right? Sending the spies to Jericho, the whole episode of crossing the Jordan, and then the very strange next thing that happens, which really is what should happen, is chapter six, the conquest of Jericho. But instead, we have circumcision and we have the first celebration of Pesach, of Passover in the land, as well as eating from the food of the land as opposed to the man, right? And that's one of the themes of the book, certainly of these first five chapters, is we are entering in order to have a spiritual existence as a nation under God. The conquest is important. The conquest is essential, but it's not the reason we are here. We are here to serve God. And that's why the first two things they do in the land are covenantal, right? You have to renew the covenant through Brit Milah. You have to renew the covenant through Passover. These are the two mitzvot aseh. These are the two positive mitzvot that if you don't do them, you're not considered to be part of the nation. You get karet, right? So these are very significant moments in the history of the people in the land. Once we've gotten through that, and we're going to go into this a little more in detail with chronology in a minute, we have the story of Jericho and the aftermath, which of course includes also the taking of the cherem and the taking of the spoils of the city, which is not allowed, and the punishment for that. We're not going to go into that story, although it is an important story. Chapter eight is the different battles of the Ai, first the defeat, then the victory, and very briefly, the story of the blessings and curses. Like I said, we'll do that next time. Chapters 9, 10, 11, 12 is the conquest stories, right? The Givonim, the center of the country, the north. Then we have what many people think of as the very boring part of the book that they zip through. But if you're an archaeologist or a tour guide or a historian, these are actually really important chapters. And that's settling the land. Who gets what? Where do they go? And this is actually very helpful to us in understanding where things are. And finally, the last three chapters are Yoshua's legacy, which we'll talk about also next time. His speech to the people and the covenant that he does with them, right? So that's just to lay out our book for us. And again, is the story more like the book of Joshua or more like the book of Judges? We're going to leave that as an open question for the moment. Before we start to enter the land, let's do the very end of Sefer Devarim, right? And of course, the beginning of Sefer Yoshua is Vayhi Acharei Mot Moshe, after Moses dies. And we're going to see the chronology in a minute. Moses dies and is buried where? Well, Torah tells us, right? He goes up on Har Nevo. Where is that? V'lo yada ish, right? Nobody knows. Nobody knows where it is. And the Jewish tradition is very emphatic on that point. We don't know where Moshe is buried. We don't want to know where Moshe is buried because we don't want it to become a shrine, a pilgrimage, an idolatry, right? And we don't know. Christians did not have the same reservations. And from Byzantine times, you already have a church on Mount Nebo, right? You can see the picture over here, the Franciscan custody of the Holy Land, the Custodia Terra Sancta, Mount Nebo, memorial of Moses. So there's a Byzantine church there and later other churches that were built in the same spot. However, we do have a very interesting site that's on this side of the Jordan, on the Israel side of the Jordan. And that's a site called Nebi Musa. Unfortunately, it was in the news today. This is, if I'm remembering correctly, this is where the very tragic friendly fire incident happened. Nebi Musa is a site on the road out from Jerusalem to Jericho. And it's a fascinating site because what is it? Hey, this is a tradition that goes back at least 1,000 years. The Arabs had that this is the site of Moses' burial. Now, that doesn't make any sense, right? We know Moses doesn't enter the land, and the Muslims know this too, right? They know the Bible, they know the story. So the suggestion is that this is not the place of the burial. They understood it's not the place of the burial, but it's a place where you can see, right? You can see across to the Jordan. This is the first place when you're coming from Jerusalem, and that's why it's the place of a shrine. But the site, Nebi Musa, right? Hanavi Moshe, Prophet Moses, goes through some very interesting incarnations in modern times. This is a site that is built in Mamluk times, right, about 600-700 years ago. And it's later on rehabilitated in the time of the Ottomans. That's what the building is that you see now. It's a large complex. But what happens is that at some point, whether it's Mamluk times, Ottoman times, there begins to be a procession and a special day, a ziyara, right? A Muslim holy day, a pilgrimage day to this site. When? Right around Easter time. And that's not accidental. There's no connection between Moshe Rabbeinu and Easter time, but rather it's meant to counteract the huge flow of Christian pilgrims coming to Jerusalem. And here we're going to have a Muslim parade, procession, leaving Jerusalem, going out to Nebi Musa. And in the early part of the 20th century, it becomes very much an expression of Palestinian nationalism, right? Of Arab nationalism, of going out from Jerusalem out to Nebi Musa, this huge procession. That's the picture that you're seeing over here. And in fact, in the very first real serious riots against Jews in the land of Israel in 1920, they begin with this procession, right? So it's actually a fascinating story, but it is not the place of burial of Moshe Rabbeinu. By the way, when this area is conquered by Jordan in 1948, they don't like all this nationalism and they stop the processions. It's not Israel that stops it. It's actually Jordan that stops it. It's begun. It stopped again, right? But the site is still an important site. Okay, let's take a look at chronology for a minute, because this is very important. It's actually very intuitive, but of course figured out by the brilliant mind of the Vilna Gaon. And it's all based on the one date that we have, right? And I ask many Jews, what date does Moshe Rabbeinu die? Many people will be able to answer you the 7th of Adar, right? Zion Adar. How do we know that? Oh, we know that. Of course we know it. How do we know it? We only know it because there's one date here that is written in the text and all the other dates grow out of that date. Well, actually, Pesach is also in the text, but let's start with the 10th of Nisan. Okay. In the book of Joshua, in the 4th chapter, after they cross the Jordan, it says that they come up from the Jordan on Yud Nisan, on the 10th of Nisan. And all you have to do is work backwards, right? Because we know that they have 3 days where they prepare to enter the land, right? So you get ready on the 6th, the 7th, the 8th. On the 9th, they already start to travel down to the Jordan, and on the 10th, they enter. Okay? So if the 6th of Nisan is when they are beginning to prepare, we know they mourn for Moshe for a month. So that takes us back to the 7th of Adar. So now that we figured out the 7th of Adar, let's do the rest of the chronology and figure it all out, right? So Moshe dies. We have a month of mourning. And then Bnei Israel are camped in Shittim, which is east of the Jordan. We're going to see a picture of the topography in a minute. Okay. And at the end of that 30-day mourning period, right, this is in the first chapter of the book of Joshua. Joshua tells the officers to get ready, to start to prepare before crossing the Jordan. He sends the spies to Jericho. He reminds the 2.5 tribes of their promise to come into the land and fight just like the people fought for them. Okay, 7, 8, 9, they prepare to enter the land. 6, 7, 8, the spies hide in the mountains after escaping Jericho. We'll come back to the spies in a minute. The 9th at night, they return to the camp. Okay, the 9th, meaning the beginning of the 9th, during the day of the 9th, they travel down to the Jordan. They cross on the 10th. Okay? They set up monuments. Perhaps this is the day that they do the blessings and the curses. We'll talk about that next time. And they are circumcised. Okay? Very important. They don't do that commandment throughout the time they're in the desert, only when they enter the land. Okay? 3 days of healing, and then Pesach, the 14th of Nisan, Pesach is celebrated, Korban Pesach, and the day after the first day of Pesach, the man stops falling and the people begin to eat the produce of the land. So it's a very jam-packed 10 days, and it really is not just about entering land, but it's entering land, like we said, in this very covenantal, nationalist way, and moving into living in a very natural way as opposed to a completely miraculous way. So that's just to get our chronology, and that is in the source sheet. So if you want to see that and understand it better, you have it in front of you. And now let's just understand a little where we are, right? So the topography, right? At the beginning of the book, Bnei Israel are, let's see, here's our Jordan, right? Here's our nice squiggly Jordan entering into the Dead Sea. So Bnei Israel are camped about 10 kilometers east of the Jordan in Shittim. Now, actually, let's erase that because I did that wrong. We want to be opposite Yericho, right? Here's Yericho. So we are in Shittim over here. Okay. One of the things that's very nice, I don't know how well you can see it on this map because I really needed to have more of Jordan, but basically the two sides of the Jordan mirror each other. What does that mean? That means in this area, there is about nice 5 kilometers or so of flat land up to the Jordan on the western side, and more or less the same thing on the eastern side. Okay. Once you get past those few kilometers, then you start to ascend into the mountains. The mountains of Jordan are actually much higher than the mountains of Israel, but it's the same basic topography, right? This is actually important when we talk about Yoshua going and helping the Givonim. He's got to ascend from this very low place. And anybody who's been to Israel and been to this area knows that as you come down from Jerusalem, your ears start to hurt because you're going way, way, way down because you're almost by the Dead Sea. Yoshua has to do that in the other direction and go up this very, very steep hill in one night in order to defend the Givonim, which is very difficult to do. The topography is going to change as we go north, and we're going to come back to that. And it's important to understand, but I wanted you just to get a sense. Bnei Israel are here. They come down to the Jordan. They cross over the Jordan. They camp by Gilgal. What is Gilgal? We'll come back to that. Okay. But just give all these things, keep them in your mind as we move along.
Can you print out that picture, Matt?
Let's talk about, can I print out the picture?
The one of him with in the coat and the hat?
You have it.
Don't you?
I think you are not part of us. Okay, good. Moving on. Although it might be nice to see the picture. Okay, let's talk about Yericho and Rahav for a minute. First of all, I want to clarify, this is not a picture of the walls of Yericho. We're going to see the walls of Yericho are very problematic. This is a picture of the walls of Chazor. Why did I bring it to you? I brought it to you because it shows you some very nice casemate wall, right? Houses in the wall. This is a classic Israelite design, that you have a wall of the city and you have houses built within the wall. We're going to come back to this when we talk about Chatzor, various other places. Okay. And we know that Rahav is in the wall, right? She lives in the wall. And what does that mean? Does that mean it looks like this? Does that mean that she's in kind of like some kind of a tower by the wall? It's not so clear, but I wanted you to have this kind of in front of you because it's a possibility of what it means, right? I just want to see, get the actual verse here. Right, sorry. All right. I don't have it in front of me right now. Sorry, but she lives in the wall. Okay. Now Rahav is a fascinating character and the story of Rahav is a fascinating character, a fascinating story. If you remember the story, the spies come into Yericho. Somehow they make contact. They know to make contact with Rahav. We'll answer perhaps why in a minute. And when they are discovered, when the people of the city, the soldiers of the city understand that there are spies in their midst and they come to Rahav, who I guess had a reputation for knowing about these things, she says, oh, no, no, they left just as the gates of the city were about to close. Go chase them. You'll be sure to catch them. Meanwhile, of course, she hides them in her house. And in return for hiding them, she asks that when they come, they save her and her family. Now, there are a lot of things that Rahav says and does that evoke for us a classic Yirei Shamayim, let's put it this way, a God-fearer, right? First of all, she's similar to Yitro, who we know about, right, from Book of Bamidbar, Yitro, Moshe's father-in-law, who comes and what does he say? Also from the Book of Exodus, I know I heard about all the miracles and the splitting of the sea and all the things that God did for you and what he did to the Egyptians. She parallels that. She says all those things. I heard about all this stuff. I know how strong your God is. I know how important he is. Okay. She writes, she basically says she believes in God who took you out of Egypt. She swears in God's name. And she also kind of mentions things that are connected to the Ten Commandments, right? Whether it's believing in God and God taking us out of Egypt, to the fact that she's not only concerned about herself, she's concerned about her parents. Now, that's fascinating. Rabbi Dr. Josh Berman points this out, right? He says, Tanakh is giving us clues. This is a good person. This is a person who is God-fearing because she wants to protect her parents. Another one of the Ten Commandments. When do we hear about that in Tanakh? We really don't hear about it. So we have these parallels to Yitro. We have these parallels to Am Yisrael and to Matan Torah. We also have a fascinating parallel to the Exodus itself, right? Because what do the spies tell her to put in her window in order to be saved, that they'll know it's her? A red string, right? Tikvat Shani. What do Bnei Israel have to put on their doorposts so that they'll be saved when God comes through and kills all of the firstborn? Red, right? Put blood on your doorposts, put a red string in your window. So Rahav is definitely harking back to a typology of a God-fearer, of someone who trusts in God, of a righteous Gentile, right? She's a very fascinating character. Now, she takes them and she hides them in the flax that she has on her roof. She also lowers them from her window with a rope. She also puts a string in her window. She works with ropes. She works with thread. Jabo Ehrlich, a scholar and a tour guide, suggests that maybe her business is flax. Maybe she has a flax workshop, right? Let's just remember, flax is a plant. You make linen from it. You have to dry it on the roof. So she has all this flax lying around. She uses it to hide the spies. She uses it to make ropes to lower them out her window. She uses it to make the strings that are wound together and dyed red to put in her window. Maybe she also uses it to make fishing nets, which we know people did, right? Maybe she was down by the Jordan and fishing, and that's how she saw the people crossing and made contact with them in the first place. So it's a very interesting thing that he points out, all of these connections to Pishtim, to flax. And one other thing, flax is highly flammable. Okay? It catches fire very quickly, maybe a little bit of a symbol of Yericho burning. Okay, so she hides them. She gives them very good advice. She says, run in the other direction. Go in the direction of the mountains. Everybody thinks you're going down to the Jordan. They go. They hide out. After she extracts from them the promise, that they will save her when they come to the town. And indeed they do. And it tells us, the book of Joshua tells us that she lives amongst the people of Israel till the end of her days. And in fact, the Gemara goes a step further and actually says that she marries Joshua, right? So that kind of a nice fitting connection there. If Moshe marries Yitro's daughter, so Joshua can marry Rahav, right? A nice little parallel there. Okay, so now let's get to the story of entering the land. Now, the spies have come back, and the people are getting ready, and they are ready to enter the land. You have the verse here in the English. I'll just read it for you also in the Hebrew, right? Joshua 3:13. First of all, we have all the instructions that Yoshua tells the people, and he tells the Kohanim, and you're going to be carrying the Aron. Vayakinoch kapot raglea Kohanim nosei Aron Hashem Adon kol haaretz b'mea yardein. Mea yardein yikaretun. Hamayim hayordim milamala vayamdu neid echad. Now, this is a fascinating story because on the one hand, it's very similar to a story that we are familiar with from 40 years earlier, right? The Kriyat Yamsuf, the splitting of the Red Sea. However, it's also very different, okay? So if you think of just, first of all, on the very basic physical level, right, you know from reading the text or seeing the Ten Commandments or Prince of Egypt, depending on your generation, right? How does the Red Sea split? If you look at my hands, it splits like this, right? It goes down the middle, splits in two directions. How does the Jordan split? It doesn't split. It stops, right? The water coming down from upstream stops by Yamdu Nedechad. And the Gemara has this great discussion of how high does it go, right? It just keeps piling up and piling up and piling up, but it stops and it stands in one place. So that's just the basic physical difference. There are very different, there are very much deeper differences as well. First of all, Kriyat Yamsuf, right, the splitting of the Red Sea, the Jewish people, the Israelites are running away. They are fleeing the Egyptians. They are in terror that they are going to be there between the Egyptians and the sea. They have nowhere to go, and this is their salvation. Entering the land is a very different thing. There might be trepidation about what's going to happen, but there isn't terror because there's nobody behind them. Okay, so that's a very important difference. The other very important difference is how do they cross here and how do they cross there? There, the sea splits because Moses lifts up his stick, or according to the Midrash, right, Nachshon jumps in and splits the sea. Here, who makes the water stop? The Kohanim, carrying the Aron. They are literally being brought into the land with Torah. Torah is taking them into the land. It's an exceedingly symbolic and important moment. And that's what's happening as they come in. Now, the other difference, and this is apparent to anyone who goes to the Jordan, particularly at this part of the Jordan, we'll talk about where this is in a second, right? The very southernmost part of the Jordan, right before it empties into the Dead Sea. What most people notice is that this is a little piddling river. It's not particularly impressive, right? Mark Twain comes after he sees the Mississippi. He is not impressed by the Jordan. Now, even if it was bigger thousands of years ago than it is today, because today we siphon off water for all sorts of reasons. Even so, do we really need a miracle? Could they not have just kind of gotten their feet a little wet and crossed over? Perhaps, but the idea is, first of all, this is happening in the springtime and when the water is at its height, but even more important, God does a miracle for Yoshua like he did for Moshe. We need to show the people that just like God is with Moshe, was with Moshe, he will be with Yoshua to the extent of doing the same miracle. Okay, so it's a fascinating thing. How do the people cross? We'll talk about that a little more next time. Do they cross in a long line from west to east, in a long line from north to south, in the shape of their encampment in the desert? Gemara has different suggestions, as do other people. Where is this place? Right. So the book of Joshua tells us that it is opposite Jericho. We have a site that is very significant to Christians, but should be just as significant to us. And in the last few years, it has become more and more known and more important, called Kasser Aliyahud, okay, which is really opposite Jericho. It's, as I said, at the southernmost point of the Jordan before it empties into the Dead Sea. The Arab name for it is Kasser Aliyahud, which means either the palace of the Jews or the breaking point, the crossing point of the Jews, right? If it's the crossing point, that's beautiful because this is where we assume that we cross. Now, why is it a big deal for Christians? As you can see, here's a whole bunch of Christians who are baptizing. Christians come or used to come, hopefully will come again from all over the world to come and be baptized in the Jordan at this place, because the New Testament tells a story about Jesus encountering John the Baptist by the Jordan. And Jesus asks John to baptize him. John baptizes him. And then Jesus has a vision of God, an epiphany. Right? And Christians already from Byzantine times, from 1500 years ago, they associate that story with this part of the river. There are churches that are built all along this area. But up until very, very recently, this was a closed military zone. Why? Because from 48 to 67, this was in the hands of Jordan, thousands and thousands of Christian pilgrims would come here every year. After the Six-Day War, this came into the hands of Israel, and it was open. And basically, the Fatah, the PLO, used this, the fact that there were churches here and monks here, and they would cross over the Jordan and use the churches and the monasteries as a base from which to go and attack other places in Israel further west. And already in the 70s, Israel has enough of this. They evacuate the monks, the nuns, they closed down the churches and they mined the whole area. And the mines are still there, as you can see from the sign. In the 80s and in the 90s, the Vatican starts to put a lot of pressure on Israel to open the site. It's a very significant site for Christians, one of the holiest sites in the world. And about 15 years ago, Israel opened it up under military supervision because we're right on the border, right? When you look back at this, when you look at this picture, okay, these guys are on the Israeli side. This structure is already Jordan, okay? You're literally on the border itself. So originally, Israel opens it up only, you had to arrange with the army. And then the last 10 years, it's been open to the public. And thank God, it's been very quiet and very nice. And tons and tons of Christians come, but Jews are starting to come more as well, particularly on Yud Nisan, right? On the 10th of Nisan, when this happened. Now, let's come back to our story of crossing, right? So we, again, we have, as we hear the story, right, we heard about that they go into the Kohanim, enter the water with the Aron. And then we have this very odd pasuk, right? 3:16. Again, I'll read it to you in the Hebrew and then we'll explain it. Right? We understood that the water coming down stands up, right, in a tower. Harchek ma'od me adam ha'ir asher mitzad tzartan. What does that mean? Far away from Adam, the town next to Sartan. And then it goes on. It tells us Neged Yericho, right? That's important for us. What's going on here? Why do we care about this town? Adam, what's the deal? So commentaries, the classical commentaries try to explain it. Radak, Rav David Kimchi says what it means is that Adam is a town that's right nearby to where they crossed. And the miracle was that even though the water is stopped up and it's piling up and piling up, right? Think about your sink, stop it up, and then it starts to overflow. Here, the water did not overflow into Adam, the town that's right next door. It's a beautiful explanation. However, Radak lived in Spain. He didn't live in the land of Israel. And so he did not know that about 30 kilometers north of where they cross is a place called Adam, right? Today, there's a bridge called Gesher Damia, but there's a place called Adam. And again, Jabo Ehrlich, who we mentioned before with the flax, he has a very interesting explanation. He says the topography of the land changes, and you can see it nicely here. Close to Yericho, it's nice and flat, right? Very flat, lots of space. But as you go north, the mountains start getting closer and closer and closer. And you see this as you drive along. And by the time you're up near Adam, the mountains are right up near the road, which is right up near the Jordan. Okay. Why is this important to us? Because every once in a while, there's a big storm, or more likely an earthquake, shakes some rocks loose from the mountains and they fall down. Now, if they fall down over here, big deal, they're going to fall down over here. But if they fall down over here by Adam, they fall into the Jordan and they block it up. And we know this happens. The last time it happened was in 1927. The Jordan was blocked up for about 20 hours, right? That's an amazing thing. What Jabo suggests is that this is the reason that the pasuk mentions Adam. It actually happens this way. Now, why is this beautiful? Because it means that this is a miracle. Meaning, why is it a miracle? Because it happens at the right time. But it's a miracle in a natural way. It's not the same as the splitting of the Red Sea. And he has a lovely phrase. He says, what's a miracle? A miracle is nature plus timing, right? So here's the nature, but it has to happen at exactly that right moment, right? So that's a lovely explanation. And it tells us that we are starting to live in a much more natural way. So that's our explanation of this pasuk. It's a very good explanation. But again, next week, we'll talk more about entering the land, and do they enter all of them over here, or do they actually enter? This is a great suggestion by a number of people, kind of in a long line, where some of them enter up here and some of them enter down here. And what does that mean? So, like I said, we'll come back to that. We're going to ignore that for the moment. Okay. The first town that they come to is the town of Jericho. Rashi brings the Midrash, which says, Yericho hi manula shel Eretz Yisrael. It is the key to the land of Israel, right? What does that mean? Why is it so important? Well, first of all, like we saw before, right? Not here, further back, sorry. Okay. We are right next to the entrance to the mountains, right? So if you can take Jericho, then the way into the mountains is open to you. Doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be so easy, but the way into the mountains is open to you. Jericho is on a major road. It's a very old and very powerful city. It goes back at least 10,000 years, if not more. So it's one of the oldest cities in the world. It's the lowest city in the world. It's got a great location. It has water and it has warm weather. Okay? So capturing Jericho is a great entryway, a gateway into the land. Now, it's a city that has, like we said, an abundance of riches. It has a spring, right, which the Arabs call Ain Es Sultan. The Jews call Ain Elisha because of the story of Elisha and making the water sweet. It has warm weather all year round. So what that means is you can have agriculture that's going on all year round. Yericho is famous for being Ir HaTmarim, right? The city of the date palms. And you can still see that today if you go to Yericho or the outskirts of Yericho. In Second Temple times, it supplies, sends supplies for the temple. It's a very significant city. It's also one of the places where they make the perfume, the Afar Simon, the balsam. So it's a wealthy city. It's a powerful city. It's still a very nice city, what Israelis are allowed to go to. But here's where we get to a kind of a sticky question, which we alluded to in the beginning. What about archaeology? So as I said before, Yericho is a very, very old city. It was already explored in an archaeological way in the 19th century. The main serious explorations were done by Kathleen Kenyon in the 1950s when this was in the hands of Jordan. It has many layers that go back to prehistoric times, to Neolithic times. However, and here's where the very big however, there is a gap in civilization from the late Bronze period, 15th century before the Common Era, to the Iron Age, 10th, 9th century before the Common Era. That's a problem because the way we understand the chronology of the story, Yoshua is taking place, give or take, the 12th century, right? Why do we not have any walls here? We're not finding walls of the city from the time of Yericho. We have huge walls from a few hundred years earlier, but we don't have any walls from the time of Yericho. What happened? Were they swallowed up? Perhaps our dating is wrong. Perhaps our site is wrong. There are a lot of different ways to possibly explain it, but there are very few really satisfactory answers. However, the archaeology does fit beautifully with the story of the rebuilding of Yericho. You have no Yericho until the 9th century or so. What's the story with Yericho, at least according to the book of Joshua and later the book of Kings? Joshua doesn't curse the city. He curses anyone who builds the city. He says, this city has to remain destroyed. Everything else in the land of Israel we need to build because we need to settle. We need to build. We need to be here. However, Yericho, because it's the first one, because it's a showing of God's power in making the walls come down, Yericho needs to remain destroyed. And he curses anyone who builds the city, right? He says, anyone who's going to build the city, with his firstborn, he's going to lay the foundations, meaning the firstborn will die when he begins to build it. And with his youngest, he will put up the doorways, right? So his children will die when he rebuilds the city. And this is a deterrent for hundreds of years until until Chiel Beit HaEli in the time of Achav. We're going to talk about Achav and Eliyahu a little later in this course. But for various reasons, Chiel Beit HaEli defies the decree. His sons do die, okay? But from that point on, Yericho is rebuilt. It remains built. It was not an injuncture not to live in the city. It was not to rebuild the city. Once the city is rebuilt, it becomes an important city. Now, again, this fits very, very nicely with the archaeology because 9th century is the time of Achav, and that's when the city is already rebuilt. The picture I put in here, I think I'm going to wait till we talk about Eliyahu and Achav to explain it, but basically this is the Nevi'ei HaBaal, the prophets of the Baal on Mount Carmel. This is from a synagogue called Dura Europus, and according to Midrash, Chiel Beit HaEli is the guy hiding here in the altar ready to light the fire for the prophets of the Baal. But we'll come back to this, I promise. The city is rebuilt. It becomes a very important city. In Second Temple times, it becomes very connected to the temple. It's also the place where the Hasmoneans build palaces. Herod builds palaces. It's kind of this winter vacation paradise for people. Later on in the Byzantine period, it's also an important city. And that's when you have the synagogue that's built. There are a few synagogues that are built in and around Yericho. This is the most famous one, the Shalom Al Yisrael Synagogue. This mosaic was found there. It's still there today. You can go see it. It's not so easy, but it's possible. The Muslims also come and build there. There's a terrible earthquake, but they come and they rebuild. So Yericho remains an important city, but there is this gap between the time of Yoshua and the time of Achav where it's not built. Okay, another subject that's interesting to explore. We know that when Bnei Israel cross into the land, they camp in a place called Gilgal. Now, Gilgal appears in a few places in Tanakh, right? We hear about it in Yoshua in a few places. We hear about it with Eliyahu. We hear about it in the book of Shoftim. Gilgal is mentioned a few times. Is it always the same? We have at least six different possible places of Gilgal. Is it a temporary camp and therefore not something we can find? Or is it perhaps something that we can find? So a very interesting archaeologist named Adam Zartal, we're going to talk more about him next time, did a huge, massive survey of all of Samaria, of the Shomron, after the Six-Day War. It took a very long time. And he found six of these strangely shaped sites, right? And if you look at the outline, the wall, it should remind you a little bit, perhaps it does, it reminded Adam Zartal, of a footprint, okay? That's what it looks like. And he says all of these sandal-shaped enclosures are Gilgals, okay? And he says, what is the idea? Gilgal really just means a pile of rocks, right? A gal of avanim. And he says, what is this idea of a Gilgal? He claims that there was some kind of a ritual significance to the shape, that the people, the Bnei Israel, would walk around the perimeter and that would kind of sanctify the place. This would explain the idea of Aliyah la Regel and calling holidays Regel, right? Where's this foot? What does that mean? Aliyah la Regel doesn't mean just going by foot to the temple, but maybe there's actually this ritualistic walking around to claim it, right? Very interesting. The pottery in the site shows us that it's early iron, meaning it's around the time of Yoshua. It's a little bit later. They're all found in the Jordan Valley. Very interesting. Take it or leave it. I'm not sure if I agree with it, but I do think it's an interesting idea. Okay, let's spend our last 10, 15 minutes or so talking about the conquests, right? And a few other things. Okay, so first of all, after we have the story of Yericho, after we have the story of the Ai, we have this very interesting story of the people called the Giv'onim. Now, if you recall the story, the Giv'onim are from an area near Jerusalem. We'll look at the four cities in a second. Not far away at all. They are very frightened of the Israelites and of their conquest. So what they do is they pretend they are from very far away and they schlep out to Gilgal, which is less than a day's walk away from them. And they manage to convince Yoshua and the people that they have been traveling for days upon days and they're from very far far away and they want to make a covenant with the people. Yahushua doesn't ask too many questions. He makes a covenant. Later on, he finds out they're locals, but he can't break his contract with them. The commentaries have a very interesting time explaining this story. The Ramban says, really, Yahushua, he bases this on a pasuk in the 12th chapter of the book. Yahushua sends out peace messages to all of the people of the land, and the Givonim misinterpret it, and they don't understand that it's really meant. Everybody else ignores it and says we're going to fight, but the Givonim really do want to make peace, but they misinterpret it. They think you have to be from far away, and so they pretend that they're from far away. In any case, it's a very interesting question. We are not going to go into it too deeply. Where really are they from? So we hear about four different cities. One is Giv'on. Today we have Giv'on HaChadasha, but the original Giv'on is an Arab town called Aljib, right? All of these are northwest of Jerusalem, okay? We have a place called Hakfira, which many people think is Ma'aleh HaChamisha, okay? We have Be'erot, which is perhaps El Bira, not far from here. Okay. And then we have Kiryat Yarim, or maybe it's Nebi Samuel, right? That's another possibility. And then we have Kiryat Yarim, which is Abu Ghosh. Okay. And you can see all of these are very close to each other. All of them, by the way, are in the land of Benjamin. Okay, in the story of the end of the book of Judges, when the Benjaminites have a civil war against the other tribes, we hear about the Givoni cities as well. And later on, we hear about it with King Saul. We'll be coming back to the Givoni cities. But they are very important for Yahushua to possess. And actually, his covenant that he has to keep is not such a bad thing, because when the Givonim are attacked by the other Canaanite kings all around, Yahushua has to come from all the way down at the bottom here and has to save them. And by doing that, he has now, as we showed before, kind of cut the land in half. And he has created this very nice all Israelite passageway. So the Givonim, whether it was a misunderstanding or not, kind of help out Yahushua. Givon is, like we said, is the Arab village of Aljib. Already in the 19th century, Edward Robinson identified it. When this was under Jordanian control in the 1950s, there was an archaeological excavation that was done here. And we know for sure that this is Giv'on, not only because of the name Aljib, which sounds a lot like Giv'on, but because they actually found jar handles that have the letters Gimel Vet Nun on them, right? Which is close enough to Giv'on to be a positive identification. It was a large city already from the Middle Bronze Age. It was a very large water system. We hear about Giv'on later on in the book of Samuel, where there's a battle between the loyalists to David under the general Yoav and the loyalists to Mephibosheth under Avner, and they're fighting by the pool of Giv'on. Is it this big cistern? Maybe, right? Later we hear about it in the time of King Solomon. The Mishkan is here. The Bama HaGdolah is here. We hear about it at the end of First Temple time. So Giv'on is an important city. It's an important location. It's mentioned a lot of times. And when they are attacked, Joshua comes to save them. And this, of course, is where we have the very famous story, right? According to Tanakh, the only time that a person did something like this, where Yahushua says, Shemesh be Giv'on Dom, V'yarech be'emek Ayalon, sun stand still in Giv'on, and moon in the valley of Ayalon, right? He basically says, freeze to the sky, sun don't set, moon don't rise. Is this because he wants the day to be longer so they can keep fighting in daylight? Is it because he wants his enemies to be blinded by the sun, right? Either way, he asks, God answers, right? Very much a miracle to stop time in its tracks. And this area of Emek Ayalon, which is where Latrun is, this is Latrun, right? The modern tank museum, but also the Crusader fortress. This area of Emek Ayalon is a very significant strategic area. Everybody wants it. So there's battles here in the time of Joshua and the Maccabees and the Crusaders and the Turks up until 1948, where Latrun is a major battleground on the road to Jerusalem. We don't manage to take it in 1948. We only take it in 1967. And today there's a tank museum here because the tank corps were the ones who tried to conquer it in 48. And in the main plaza of the museum, you can see the design. It's very nice, subtle, but if you know the story, it's very obvious. You have a sun, right, with the rays, because sun stands still in Gibeon, right? So it's a nice harking back to the story where the story took place. The final set of battles happens in the north, right? And in the north, we only hear about one city that's destroyed because it is Rosh Kol Ha'arim, right? It's the most important one. All the other cities are preserved and the Israelites move into them. But Chatzor is the most important city, and that one is destroyed. Now, as we said before, there are places that validate the story of Tanakh very clearly and places that are more complicated. Chatzor is very clear, okay? It is a city that it was excavated over many years, was excavated by Yigael Yadin in the 50s and the 60s. It's been excavated more recently by Amnon Ben-Tor. Yadin excavated mostly the Solomonic, the city from King Solomon, as well as the lower city from the Canaanites. Amnon Ben-Tor excavated the Canaanite city on the top, the upper city. And what he discovered is this huge structure, which may have been a palace. It may have been a temple. There's some kind of an altar in the front. It's not so clear what it is. But what's important for our purposes is it shows signs of a massive, massive conflagration and destruction, not just of the place, but there are statues, Canaanite statues of the Baal, right? One of the major Canaanite gods who's decapitated. So you have a fire, you have destruction of idolatry from the 12th century, fits beautifully, fits perfectly with the story. Okay? So it's destroyed in the time of Yoshua, but unlike Jericho, it doesn't have to remain destroyed, but it is rebuilt and it's going to be important later in our story of King Solomon. Now Chatzor has major important temples, okay? Canaanite temples, matzevot, monuments, all kinds of monoliths and statues and gods. And we see this also in other Canaanite towns, like in Megiddo, like in Gezer over here, where you have these monuments as well, which is not 100% clear what they are, but clearly they are something that is connected to ritual, that is connected to covenant. What we have that remains of Canaanite culture tells us that it was a very powerful and very influential culture. Now, the Israelites and Joshua are commanded to get rid of it, right? We hear about it already in the book of Devarim. Get rid of all of that idolatry. Get rid of the inhabitants of the land. They are going to turn you astray. Now, even in the book of Joshua, but definitely in the book of Judges, we see that that's not really what happens, okay? In many cases, the primary example is the Givonim, but not only. Joshua doesn't kill off all the Canaanites. He makes them work for him by ulemas. They have to do forced labor. They have to live under the yoke of the Israelites, but they're not gotten rid of, and their culture is not gotten rid of. Now, this seems more humane to us. We are living in a very different time. However, it causes enormous problems because it means that this idolatry sticks around throughout First Temple times, and it's one of the major issues of First Temple Israel is this connection, this deep and abiding connection to idolatry, which is very hard to take out of the land. And part of it is because this culture stays around and is very, very strong. Okay, our last little bit here is dividing up the land. Once the years of conquest, the 7 years of conquest are over, the people gather in what becomes the capital for the next almost four centuries, and that's Shiloh. And we're going to talk more about Shiloh when we get to the book of Samuel. But they gather in Shiloh. They set up the tabernacle, the Mishkan there, okay? And it becomes the place that is the most important site until Shiloh is destroyed in the time of Eli, in the time of Shmuel. Okay? But meanwhile, they set up the tabernacle and they start to divide up the land. Okay? And the land is divided, and it's where we hear about kind of this religious center. It's not where Joshua does the final covenant. And that's why we're going to talk about that next week. That happens in Shechem, but Shiloh becomes the de facto capital for the next few centuries. It's a very significant site, and it's the place where the land is divided up. Okay, so just two different things that we want to look at here. First of all, the division of the land into tribes. Okay, and whatever, every one of these maps is slightly different. So if you see something and you say, ah, but Shimon is supposed to be in Judah. Yes, it's true. I just happened to pick this map. I like the colors. But they all are more or less correct. but there are variations that need to be fixed. Okay, so just to understand, we have our 2.5 tribes on the eastern side, right? Reuven, Gad, and half of Manasseh. And you also get a sense of the enormity of some tribes and the very smallness of other tribes, right? So the major tribes, Judah, Ephraim, Manasseh, they have huge amounts of land. Benjamin does not have a lot of land, but he's located in a very, very central position. The Mishkan is, according to the Gemara, the Shiloh is in Benjamin. It's a little tricky to do that in real life, but certainly the temple is going to be located in Benjamin because Jerusalem is divided between Judah and Benjamin. So these are our major tribes. Okay. We've got, less significant, although with lots of land, tribes in the north, Asher, Naphtali, Zvulun, Yisachar. Shimon has a story to himself. Maybe we'll talk about him a little in Sefer Shoftim. And Dan starts out over here, right, down here near Judah, and doesn't have enough space. We'll talk about that when we talk about Shimshon and the Plishtim. And eventually he goes further north and finds himself a new place. And that's why the Tel Aviv buses are called Dan, and that area is called Gush Dan. But if you go up north, you will visit Tel Dan, which is also part of Dan. So two different places. The other thing to notice is this other map over here on the right. And of the nachalot, of the inheritances that are given to the tribes, you also have the story of the Levites and the Kohanim. Okay? The Levites and the Kohanim, the tribe of Levi does not get his own, and you can see the tribes are set out differently here, slightly. The tribe of Levi does not get its own land. It is scattered throughout the people. We have 48 Levite cities, which include 13 cities that are for Kohanim. Okay? It also includes the cities of refuge. Those are the ones with the big stars by them. The idea is that they are meant to be the teachers, and that's why they're scattered throughout the land. Why are the cities of refuge also cities of Kohanim? That's where we get to interesting questions of atonement and what do you do in a city of refuge and who's responsible for sin. We are not going to get into those questions. But what is interesting is you have a concentration of Kohanim cities that are in the southern Hebron Hills, including Hebron, by the way, and Eshtamoa and others. And in much later Jewish history, right, in the post-Second Temple times, these still seem to retain some kind of a Kohen identity. In the north as well, we have Kohen cities that retain a Kohen identity. So that's just a fascinating thing to think that that identity can carry on centuries after this concept of Nachalot has basically fallen apart because the 10 tribes are exiled. Okay, so that's our very quick introduction to the book of Joshua. We are going to go more deeply into detail next week when we talk about the blessings and curses. But let's see if there are questions I need to answer here. Go back to the beginning. Sorry, let me do that faster. A labyrinth used for meditative walks. Yes, very nice. But also it's just kind of nice that the different layers upon layers. Whoever is not muted, mute, please. We'll do questions after this. A similar labyrinth at the University of Edinburgh. I don't know. That's a very interesting question. Maybe the drawing is modeled on the labyrinth, but I don't think it's from Edinburgh, so I don't know. Spoke and center road system, swift and thorough conquest. Right. It's true. The book of Joshua also is not 100% that everything is conquered all at once. That is very true. And it leaves it open. Travels of the Israelites. Right. I didn't draw it so carefully. Don't take that. Don't take my squiggles on the map as how they entered the land. But no, they don't go in through Beersheba, although we do hear about conquest of Arad. And that's a very disputed question and not one that I am going to go into because there's essentially very little in the way of any kind of archaeological evidence. Rivka Esther says, Nachyomi is supposed to begin a new cycle. Very nice. Okay, good. Perfect timing. Not making Moshe's gravest sign should be Musar Haskel. Do the Franciscans disagree with the Arabs that the Jews have no connection to the land? I'm not even going to go into that, although that is an interesting question. Okay, Gilgal, right. So this is a private question, but I will just say the question was, do the circumcisions happen before entering into the land? We know, we hear about that the last time they circumcise is the ones who were in Egypt. And then, and it says it explicitly in the Torah that they do not circumcise in the desert, right? And the suggestion is it was dangerous. They're traveling, right? It's not safe. But Rav Yitzchak Rosen suggests that maybe they're saving the mitzvah of circumcision to enter the land. Maybe they need to renew the covenant in the land. And that's a very interesting idea. Okay, let's see. We're skipping all about the shrines. Bones of Joseph we're going to do next time. Hey, something like that happened with Niagara, but it was an ice flow. I don't think that's what happened with the Jordan, but nice. The Derech HaMelech on the Moab side. Oh, yeah, that is a good question. But yes, it's basically on that flat plain. It's exactly the flat plain near the river, not on the mountain plateau. If I'm remembering correctly, I have to check, but I'm pretty sure it's the flat plain. If anyone in Israel, the Beit Sefer Sadeh has four more trips in the footsteps of Yehoshua. Oh, very nice. Thank you. Okay, that's a great connection. Also, the Beit Sefer Sadeh, people who live in Israel, they go usually Pesach and Sukkot on Chol HaMoed. They actually go to Yericho. I went with them last year. It was amazing. You got to go to the Tel of Yericho and to the Shalom HaYisrael Synagogue. Very, very interesting. Okay, any other questions? No. Thank you for all the compliments. Is it true the land wanted is very lush and great for flocks? Unfortunately, I don't know enough about Jordan. I am focusing on the land of Israel. Also, how it was 3,000 years ago is not necessarily how it is today. Menashe may have entered the land. Yes, you have very interesting midrashim based on Divrei HaYamim. Also, fascinating question. I cannot post a PDF of my illustrations and maps, but basically pretty much everything that I take is off of the web and Wikipedia, and you can see it in the YouTube and do screenshots if you want. Okay. Yes, I'm not going into the negative. It's a good question. I don't know enough about it to talk about it. What I do know to say is that following the progression of where B'nai Israel were in the desert is a very tricky thing to do. We don't even know where Mount Sinai was. Okay? And that's not so surprising, because even if we are talking about lots of people, and that's questionable how many people there were, they're nomads. They're moving on. They're not building towns and villages. So it's a very tricky question. What exactly is that trajectory? Where do they go? Do they cut through the Negev? Do they go around in the Sinai? There are books about it. I am not your resource for that, unfortunately. I try to stick to the land of Israel. Did the walls of Jericho sink into the ground? That's one suggestion, right? That the Midrash does talk about that, and that's why they're not around anymore. Archaeologists don't love that answer, but it is an interesting answer. Other questions? Anybody want to ask questions just, you know, live as humans? Yes. Hi. Peter, hello.
Julie, hello. Do you know of any archaeological textbooks that if I have the chronology correct, the end of the Bronze Age civilization, when, you know, there were these huge trade routes that went from Iran all the way to the Western Mediterranean, and right around 1100, 1200 BCE, it all falls apart.
And that's all connected to this Egypt story. That's all connected to that. Right. So you want to understand. Let me think about it, because I have your email and I will send you something if I think of something good. But yeah, Egypt is always the gorilla in the room. What happens in Egypt, if they're strong, it affects us. If they're weak, it affects us. So the fact that they have this period of weakness in the 12th, 11th century has a huge impact on our region and the larger region as well. But I will look into if I can find a book for you. Anybody else?
Well, thank you.
Yes. Was the crossing of the Red Sea or the Reed Sea, Yam Suf? Can you speculate on that?
Is it Reed? That's your question?
Yes.
Yeah. So if I remember correctly, Yam Suf is clearly a Reed Sea. Who are the ones who come up with the red? I have to go back and check, but I think it's a Greek mistranslation, if I'm remembering correctly. And it's sort of got, and today we say Red Sea, it has all the coral, whatever, but really it is a Reed Sea. It is clearly not a Red Sea. I think it's the Greeks who mess it up, but I would have to go back and check.
That's what I want.
Shevet Zvolun according to your map, according to your map, doesn't have access to the Mediterranean.
Very good question, right? Zvulun lechof yamim yishkon. Is he really lechof yamim? So we tend to rely more on what's written out in Sefer Yoshua and less on the blessings that Jacob and Moshe give. And in Sefer Yoshua, he doesn't seem to have access to the sea. So what do the commentaries do with that? That's a good question. I don't remember exactly, but the maps are relying on the way it's laid out in Yoshua.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you, everyone. I don't know if you want to do coming attractions, Maxine, but thank you.
Yeah,
everybody.
Sure. Thank you everyone for coming for the first edition in this new series. Tonight, of course, at 8:30 Eastern, we have our Parsha Shir. Rabbi Moshe Shulman will be talking about Shirat Miriam. What else? Tomorrow, Rabbi Kelman will be teaching his Shir on the Parsha at 9 a.m. And then Sunday, there is a day off. Usually Sunday is when Rabbi Menachem Leibtag is teaching, but he is taking a week. And then starting next Sunday, we will be looking at Sefer Shemot as a whole with him. And then going on the rest of the week, we are continuing some of our the new series that we started. Also, we're going to be looking at we're going to go perek by perek, looking at the narrative of Eliyahu HaNavi with Rabbi Alex Israel. So there will be some tie-ins there, I'm sure. So looking forward to seeing you and have a Shabbat Shalom. If you're not back before then, but thank you so much.
Thank you, Maxine. Shabbat Shalom, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you, Shuli.